The last time you saw a doctor, how long did you actually get to spend with the doctor? And how did that time compare with the amount of time you spent in the waiting room or waiting in the examination room? By the accounts of most patients and many doctors, there's just not a lot of time together. And when people work fast, things can be missed. Patient care can suffer, and so can the patients. Victoria Sweet cites a case very important to her, her father's, in the beginning of her book, Slow Medicine, The Way to Healing. Victoria Sweet is herself a physician who worked for more than 20 years at Laguna Honda Hospital in San Francisco. She is also an associate clinical professor of medicine at the University of California, San Francisco. Her previous book, God's Hotel, is about that hospital where she worked. Victoria Sweet, thanks for joining us on The Exchange today.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
So tell us about that story about your father and a grand mal seizure, which was not his first.
That's right. It's quite a remarkable experience for me, and what really impelled me to pull it together and write this second book. So my dad's fairly elderly, and he has a history of seizures, and he had one of his seizures. He went to the emergency room, and in the emergency room, they misdiagnosed him. They thought it was his first seizure. So they admitted him because at his age, the most likely cause of a first seizure would have been a stroke. So they admitted him with the diagnosis of probable stroke, and they began treating him for that. Now, I show up, and not only am I a physician and an author, but the docs and the nurses were reading my first book, God's Hotel, in their book club at the time, so I was a bit of a VIP. Nevertheless, in the 10 days my father was in that hospital, I could not get anyone to change the diagnosis, to stop treating him for a stroke. And it finally ended up...
Why was it so hard to change? That was the part I really didn't understand. Why was it just so hard to, like, click whatever box or, you know, highlight this area and change the diagnosis?
Well, that's really the essence of the matter, because we've always made wrong diagnosis. I mean, we get the wrong story, we get the right story, but whatever. But because of electronic health records, there's a couple of issues of the things that have been going on about the last 10 years in order to make medicine more efficient, and they've actually made it way less efficient. One of them is electronic health records, and the second one is this whole idea of a hospitalist. So instead of having your own doctor who knows you when you get admitted to the hospital, you are assigned a rotating group of docs who are there about every 8 hours, every 12 hours, and so they don't know him. And they don't really pass along information person to person. They pass it along in electronic health records. So once something gets in the computer, it turned out to be impossible to change. What that means is that, why was it impossible to change? I don't know their particular medical records, but what I could see when I actually got the electronic health records after we managed to save my father's life. He was having a complete downhill course, as I'm sure your listeners will understand, where he's being treated for stroke, so then he's not allowed to eat, and then they put in IVs and they put in tubes, and one thing was leading to another, and I could see as a doc it was not going to end up well. And we ended up actually declaring him to be a hospice case so that we could take him out and I could take him off all those medications, and he had his 95th birthday about 2 months ago, still at home.
So he managed to live through that experience, and
yes,
he still
but he
does.
Would never have lived through it if we hadn't gotten him out. Really, there's just no way.
So essentially, you had to, well, I won't say out and out lied to the hospital, but, you know, said we're going to bring hospice in,
mm-hmm.
essentially indicating or implying that, yeah, we accept that the end is near.
Yes, exactly. Because that was the only way the doctors would kind of agree to stopping the treatment they were giving him. It was one of those times where they gave him a medicine to do X, and then that medicine had a side effect, so they gave him another medicine to do Y. And one thing was, I know, we call this in medicine, we call circling the drain.
Hmm.
It's not a good thing.
No, you do make a distinction, Victoria, in the book between medicine and healthcare. And you say the essence of medicine is story. That's a really interesting claim.
Yes, well, we've been, about 25 years ago, medicine was suddenly being called healthcare. As if doctors could deliver health care, provide health care, as if we knew how to do that or could do it, as if health care is a box of retail health care and we're retail clerks. But medicine, we learn to practice medicine. There's a reason we say practice medicine, and doctors learn to be professionals, to have ethics. And this change was dramatic because once healthcare, this idea of healthcare took hold, we ended up with hospitalists, we ended up with electronic health records, we ended up with many other efforts to get control of our healthcare costs that have made the story, what actually is going on, impossible to put together. And so if a doc, if I can understand your story, why you're in my office, what's actually going on, when it started, and then I can examine you and correlate what's going on in your body, your physical body, with what you've told me, and then get the labs and x-rays necessary, it turns into a story. It turns into a story, and if I can get the story right, I get the diagnosis.
So over your 20 years at that one hospital in San Francisco, how much did you see patient care change just within your own scope?
Well, that's a great question, and thanks for asking that. It actually, it was a very odd hospital, very unusual hospital. It had originally been the San Francisco Almshouse, and that was how we used to have a way to take care of the sick and the poor and the unemployed and the homeless and before there was health insurance, and that was every county would have a big old county hospital and a county almshouse, which... And if you were really sick and anybody could show up at the county hospital and be taken care of. And if you needed more care or there's something going on and you had no place to stay, they'd send you to the almshouse. And that's what Laguna Honda Hospital was. It was a place that anybody could go. And unlike every other almshouse in the country, it still existed. So it was an amazing place to practice medicine. And actually, healthcare did not reach it until about 5 years ago.
All right, we'll explore the difference between healthcare and medicine and talked about the kinds of changes that got expressed on a day-to-day basis in Laguna Honda and elsewhere across the country as well. Victoria Sweet writes from her own experience in the book Slow Medicine, The Way to Healing. You can join the conversation on the Exchange by phone or by email. We'll come back to the Jefferson Exchange with Victoria and you in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Victoria Sweet, Dr. Victoria Sweet, a physician who worked for more than 20 years at Laguna Honda Hospital in San Francisco, an associate clinical professor of medicine at the University of California, San Francisco. She examines her business and finds it lacking in some ways, primarily because of speed, other features that come in there as well. Her book is called Slow Medicine, The Way to Healing. You can join the conversation on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So you mentioned that at Laguna Honda, medicine did not morph into healthcare until 5 years ago. How did the change come in? I mean, has it come in through the pressure of insurance companies, through hospital organizations? What?
In a way, it came in by a style. So we were just over the hill to the poorhouse. Nobody paid too much attention to us. It was still is a big old place with, we had almost 1,200 patients. There were 30 docs, 1,500 staff, huge place. But nobody paid too much attention until about 15 years ago it started. It didn't culminate until about 5 years ago. So about 15 years ago, some healthcare efficiency experts came in. They were hired by the city to find efficiencies, or really find inefficiencies. And that was the beginning. They came in, and the way the healthcare efficiency experts worked is they came in as consultants. So if they would propose a measure to save the hospital, let's say, $1 million, they would get 10% of whatever they recommended. But they wouldn't get fined if what they recommended ended up costing more. And that's what we've seen across the country. We've seen consultants, healthcare consultants, come into hospitals, medical practices, offer to change things to save the doctor, the hospital money, and yet, ironically, practically every measure they propose has ended up costing more money, as we all know, since our healthcare budget has gone through the roof the last 15 years. So that's kind of where it started. But it culminated about 5 years ago.
It sounds very corporate, almost like the CEOs manipulating the bottom line to increase the share price.
Well, that's exactly what it is. And I have to say I've begun to sort of really hit me over the last couple of years. It is an industry. It really is. Healthcare is an industry. It's incredibly lucrative. Everybody is piling on. I mean, if you just look at the statistics, it's fascinating. If you add together everything that we pay doctors, nurses, therapists, physical therapists, social workers, psychologists, psychiatrists, it ends up to be about 18 cents of every dollar we spend, only 18 cents on all that care. We spend more than that in healthcare marketing, in building hospitals, corporate suites, sending it to Wall Street. It's a huge corporation. It's one of the latest sort of discoveries of corporate America. Healthcare.
So did anything really you mentioned that things became different at Laguna Honda about 5 years ago, and then it would have been just since that time that you began to see the first effects of the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare. Did that make much of a difference in how things were done there?
You know, it really different because in a lot of ways, Obamacare, which I actually read.
Oh, really?
The only person
you love reading things. I noticed that you love reading. You could spend an afternoon with patient records.
It's true, but they're fascinating because that's where the story is. And so the Obamacare, I can tell you for a fact, is actually 922 single space pages. And so it's not just the 5 or 10 things you hear about it. It's thousands and thousands and thousands of little mini laws, regulations, corporate takeovers of little pieces. It's huge. And the kind of things that the Republicans are talking about, replacing
and replacing
are just a few things, but most of the stuff in Obamacare was already in place before there was Obamacare. It was things that were already there and corporate wanted more of them. I could give you some examples. But,
sure.
For instance, that Medicare is not allowed to negotiate for health care prices.
Mm-hmm. Which was a feature of the...
Crazy. That's kind of crazy.
For health care prices or for drug prices?
For drug prices, for drug prices. Or that, I love this one, that insurance companies have to spend 80 cents on their health care, right? They have to. They were already doing that. It's kind of like Uncle Remus and the rabbit in the tar fields kind of thing, where they're already doing that, and they can spend 20 cents of every dollar on administration. So they end up spending 60 cents of every dollar we give insurance companies on healthcare. So naturally, we're not getting much value for our money. So that's the kind of things that many other pieces. It's a huge law.
Victoria Sweet's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, a doctor herself. Her book is Slow Medicine, The Way to Healing. So the idea of slow medicine, you didn't coin the term, you tell us. Any idea when it first appeared?
Yes, I do. It was started in Italy, where the slow food movement started, and it was started by the same group of people. So there was a slow food movement started in the late 80s by this... scholar, really, who was Italian, been in Berkeley, came back to his town and was shocked to discover a McDonald's being built in Rome. And he decided as his rebellion to start, instead of fast food, he started a slow food movement, which is our slow food movement that then came to the States. And that same idea, because slow medicine isn't really slow temporally. It's not really about the amount of time. It's about the style and the quality of time. It's the opposite of fast medicine. Fast medicine being this corporate, you know, you come in with a certain set of symptoms and a robot could virtually examine you. And wouldn't it be great if you could do it all on computer and Amazon could deliver your medications by drone? That's fast medicine. And so slow medicine was coined by a lot of people as a parallel to the slow food movement. But it started in Italy. It started about 10 years ago in Italy, the slow medicine movement, so as a rebellion, really.
It sounds almost like a... I don't know. It conjures up for me anyway the idea of a country doctor, somebody who knows you a little better, spends a little time with you. It's not like going into these gleaming white Star Wars-like examination rooms where bing, 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 you ask a couple questions and then they're gone.
That's right. That's right. And the ironic thing is because I was allowed to practice medicine that way in this old-fashioned hospital, I had enough time. What I was amazed about was how efficient it was. And that, what I mean specifically is saved money. And I'll give you one example. Most of the patients that we would get in that old-fashioned hospital would be very sick, but chronically sick, lots of different diseases. And they'd come there for various reasons. Some would go home. Some would end up staying for a long time. But I had enough time to examine them, figure out what's going on. The average person came in on between 15 and 26 medications. And it would turn out once I started having the time to examine them and get their old charts, they only needed about 5 of those medications. So I could stop about 10 to 15 medications, and that saves an immense amount of money. And the reason nobody else had ever stopped them was because if you have a minute, 5 minutes with a patient who's on 15 medications or 25 medications, you don't stop everything. You don't stop anything. You don't have the time. All you do is can order labs and renew their medications. That's it.
Is this like what you talked about with your father, where you're taking some medications to get rid of the side effects of the other medications? Yeah.
Right. And then there's a whole group of medications with my dad, for instance, that because he had this stroke diagnosis, they were giving him because that's part of the stroke protocol. So as soon as he got home, we just had to take him off all those medications, except for a seizure medicine. That was about it.
Well, I was amazed to hear that he's still alive at age 95.
Yes, he had his 95th birthday, and he cut his own cake.
Congratulations and happy birthday to your father.
Yes.
Victoria Sweet's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is Slow Medicine, The Way to Healing. She's a medical doctor herself, 20 years at Laguna Honda Hospital in San Francisco. She is an associate clinical professor of medicine at the University of California, San Francisco. You can join the conversation on the Exchange as we talk about medicine and what can make it fast or slow, or what can just make it better. 800-838-3760 to join the conversation by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. You bring us back in the book to your college days and the Swiss-American family you stayed with. What did you learn from them?
Well, Switzerland is really a very fascinating place because in a lot of ways it's the opposite of the United States in many ways. It's tiny, right? It's like 7-8 million people. And it also has an intact tradition that goes back even before the Middle Ages, before Rome. It has an intact tradition. And yet we've always used Switzerland as kind of a model in the States. In fact, our United States was actually based on the way Switzerland is put together.
With the cantons?
Beautiful, that's right. It's a confederation of cantons. We actually use that. And Obamacare actually was modeled, sort of some of the essence of it was actually modeled on the Swiss system. So the Swiss family I stayed with when I was a student had brought, they were American, but they'd lived in Switzerland about 15 years, and they'd brought back a lot of these ideas, but especially this idea that, you know, mostly there's nothing new under the sun, as the Bible says. And, you know, when something new appears, one place to go looking for an answer is in the past, because chances are there have been dictators before and we didn't know what to do with, you know. Chances are there have been epidemics. And to start by looking at what can we find in the past before we invent something new. And that's one of the things I learned from this family was this style, again, and I thought of it as a slow style, but I didn't have the words back then to think of it as slow, a style of connecting yourself up with the past, the present, and the future, that you're part of this stream, you're part of this river of human life and culture, and you're not part of a factory. You're not this singleton worker on a conveyor belt, which is not only how they're treating doctors and nurses these days, but how the corporations are attempting to treat everyone.
You had not decided on medicine as a career at the time you knew this Swiss family. So what was it that led you to that decision?
Well, I fell in love with Carl Jung. Carl Jung's a psychiatrist who brought us many of our important ideas. And I had gone through college in a very, you know, kind of crazy time right here. And I live in Silicon Valley, right, when all this stuff was happening, organic food and computers and the war and this whole bag, drugs, a whole bag of tricks. And I didn't know what to do after I got out of college, so I went traveling, and in a bookstore I discovered Carl Jung's memoirs, Memories, Dreams, and Reflections, and he's also Swiss, and I loved the life he'd put together for himself. He lived on a lake in Zurich, and he, you know, was a psychiatrist who saw well-paying neurotic patients in the morning and illuminated medieval manuscripts in the afternoon, and he brought an incredible depth to his work with his psychiatric patients. So I decided that I would be a Jungian analyst, and that's how I got to medical school.
So how rare were women in medical school, even that recently?
Yes, that's true. Well, we had a lot of women in our class. We had 7. The class before us, out of a class of about 80. So we had 7, and that was like a big deal. The class before us had 3. The class before that had 1. So we were actually the beginning of this whole wave of women in medicine. So it was quite unusual. Many of the men did not like to see us there. And it was difficult to learn how to be a woman in that kind of profession, to be tough enough to be able to say no, to function, and at the same time to not lose what I think women and women like men bring to their crafts, which is a kind of openness and some humility, which I must say is not my your area of expertise, but I'll throw that out.
Humility is not your area of expertise?
Not really, no. But you know, would never have written this book if humility. Believe me, I wouldn't have written this book.
but you know, there is a level of patience here. We already talked about how much you love reading patient records, and you read all 922 pages of the Affordable Care Act. And in a similar way, though, you'll spend that kind of time with a patient. You describe your first full diagnosis in medical school as ordered by Dr. Guru Shanti. Tell us about this amazingly long examination.
Well, that's a great question. So one of the things that's gone, you know, I'm sure your listeners one of the things they've noticed is mostly the doctors don't examine you anymore. And when I was in medical school, Dr. Guru Shanti was taught us how to examine the patient, and this physical exam is truly a beautiful thing, and to do it well takes hours. I mean, if you're a medical student like I was and you decide that, you know, this sort of your exam was to fully examine a patient, which is what happened with Dr. Guru Shanti, who taught us, you know, at the end of his course, he gave us a patient. Each of the medical students, we had a patient at the VA that we could spend as much time as we needed to do this full physical exam. And it took me all afternoon. It took me about 4 hours, and I was a ringing wreck, and so was the patient when I was done. But it was unforgettable. I can see the patient to this day. And I should say that I talk about this story in Slow Medicine, and I've heard from several docs who tell me that they cried when they read that, because it put them right back to the time when they were examining their first patient. All of us remember that first patient. And what an incredible experience to start at the hair, the pulse, the blood pressure, the fingernails, and do the whole entire thing. How much information is in that beautiful physical exam? That's part of the craft of medicine.
Victoria Sweet is our guest on the book, on the exchange. Her book is Slow Medicine, The Way to Healing. Well, obviously, you can't spend 4 hours on every patient. So what do we extrapolate from that experience that can help doctors in a hurry now?
That's right. Well, the reason doctors are really in a hurry, oddly enough, is that it's not that we have less time with patients. We do have a little less time, but actually we have about 12 and a half minutes. We used to have 15, so it's different. But what's taking all our time is actually nothing more than all the forms, the electronic health records, the computer, this immense bureaucracy that has descended on us. Most doctors have literally no time to do anything. But if you have 12 and a half minutes, it's surprisingly a lot if you actually have those 12 and a half minutes. So the way the craft of medicine is learned is you start with that kind of exam, and you gradually learn about the body because, you know, I've probably done thousands of exams. I know I've done thousands of exams in my life. And so you acquire a sense of normal, and you acquire a sense of where to go when you're looking for the diagnosis. So you can end up being fairly efficient in 15 minutes, let's say, when you have the kind of background. You pick a piece of that exam that's relevant. So if somebody comes in with a cough, you would look at the ear, nose, and throat, and you'd look at the chest and the neck and the heart, but you wouldn't have to do most likely a neurological exam or a brain exam. So you can they become almost modules. Physical exam is like a module in your brain, and you can pull it up for that particular patient and only spend 15 minutes and do 5-10 minutes of the exam.
You know, I find myself coming back again and again to your discussion of doctors with their faces and screens. And in fact, at the beginning of the book, you described the doctor who was sure it was a stroke with your father,
and it
wasn't, with his face stuck in a screen, not looking up at you even when you talk to him. It seems like on one level that should speed things up, you know, boop, boop, beep, beep, you know, hear the answers to the questions. But on the other hand, it sounds like one of the problems you ran into was that nobody could figure out how to change something that already had been recorded in the electronic health records.
And I couldn't get anybody to go in his room. There was nobody in his room. It was eerie, Jeff. That's what got me most of all, because, you know, I've been in the hospital system for many decades, and I know how, I thought I knew how they worked, you know, how kind of the levels to go to, who to get. But if there's no physical human being around, that's the main thing there was, is there was no, there was nobody in his room. There wasn't even anybody in the nursing station. There were like these computers, and periodically somebody would arrive and sit in front of the computer and then leave again. So it wasn't even a situation where I used to just walk down a hallway and grab somebody, right? Mm-hmm. Grab a doctor-like person and bring him in the room and say, look, see, this man does not have a stroke. And that doctor might go, oh, my God, you're right. We need to do something about this. But in my dad's case, in a modern healthcare case, I couldn't find anybody on the hallways dragged into the room. I couldn't find anybody at all. It was empty.
More stories about medicine in today's world and how Victoria Sweet would like to change that to slow medicine. That's her book, The Way to Healing, the subtitle. You can join us on The Exchange by phone or by email when we come back in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is Dr. Victoria Sweet, a physician for 20 years at Laguna Honda Hospital in San Francisco. Wrote a book about that hospital, God's Hotel. She still is an assistant clinical professor of medicine at the University of California, San Francisco, and thinks a lot about her profession and how fast people move and what that does to patient care. Hint, it doesn't make it better. Her book is called Slow Medicine, The Way to Healing. You can join the conversation on The Exchange by phone, 800-838-3760, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Jamie in Medford dropped off a couple of, well, a comment and a question. His comment is, there's too much business in medicine and not enough medicine in business. And his question is, what happened to general practitioners and why don't we have them anymore? Didn't know we didn't.
Yes, well, general, what we used to call GPs kind of disappeared into family practitioners. Mm-hmm. And so that's the first thing. That's where they live, as the term family practitioner. Although internists, which is what I am, so we did 3 years of a medical residency, we're also kind of GPs in that we can sort of do everything. So they didn't disappear. They turned into another kind of subspecialty called family practice.
Is that a difference, or is it just a marketing term because, you know, family connotes some sort of warmth and bring the kids, too?
The beautiful question, Jeff. Yes and no. GPs were classically... You had 4 years of medical school, and after a year of internship, you would get your medical license, and then you would be a GP. And in fact, I did that for about 8 or 9 years. I was a real GP and went out into the country, and I'd see kids, and I read my own x-rays and put on casts, that kind of whole spectrum. And there are docs who still do that, but it's pretty rare because... that family practitioner stepped in and said, you know, in order to do that with how complicated medicine is, we actually need 3 years of our own medical residency. So there was a difference. They changed the name, but they also, they have an extra 2 years of training in a hospital. So they can, you know, learn how to do that well, learn how to take care of kids, learn how to take care of old people, learn how to take care of women's problems with more training. So they do have considerably more training than your classic GP, but they do the same things, and it was kind of a marketing change.
Speaking of training in a hospital, there's a part of the book that confuses me just a bit, which is you got assigned to the medicine floor in the hospital. Isn't all the hospital committing medicine?
Yes. Did you say committing medicine?
Yes.
Oh, I love that. That's great. Yes, and that was why we struggled with my editor. I wanted to have it be capital, make that distinction. So everybody's giving medicine. It's actually was quite tricky. Everybody's giving medicine, but in medicine as a profession, we talk about, you know, obstetrics as a specialty or surgery as a specialty. And then, to confuse things, medicine is also a specialty. If you think about it, it is not surgery, not obstetrics, not pediatrics. What is it? It's really the care of the adult.
Okay.
So it is confusing, but that's so. So it was a ward. It was a whole floor where it's not surgery, it's not OB, and it's not peds, and it's not neurology, it's medicine. So what are we seeing there? We're seeing people with severe asthma or cancers or heart attacks or confusing infections. When I was doing that as a resident, it was in San Francisco in the middle of the AIDS epidemic. So our medicine floor was completely filled with AIDS patients, and they were spilling all over the hospital because there were so many.
You know, these stories from medical school are really interesting on a number of different levels. And one of them is the way that you admire the coolness and the calm of medicine, which is obviously necessary because you can't break down and cry over every patient and every condition because you'd never get any work done. But how do you find the balance then between that coolness and that calm, that scientific level detachment, and yet still be caring?
That's a beautiful question, Jeff, really. I'd say there's a difference from being cold. There's cold and there's warm, and then there's calm and cool. And the trick is to find calm and cool without being cold. Because you don't really want somebody who is emotional in a certain sense. And I'll give you an example that struck me. So when I first had to sew up people, and I, mind you, as I talk about in the book, the first time I had to draw blood, I passed out.
Oh, that's right.
I'm not your, you know, sort of normal, natural-born doctor kind of person. I had to really struggle with that. And when I first had to sew up people, especially when I was by myself in these practices, these general practices out in the middle of nowhere, somebody come in, I'd have to sew them up, so I'd sew them up. And I remember distinctly looking at my hands, maybe the second or third time, and they were shaking. It was so... Right? Got to sew somebody up, but your hands are shaking. Not too good.
No. That would be a
right?
Problem,
yeah. It was okay. I got through it. And then about 6 months later, I looked at my hands, and they weren't shaking anymore. They weren't shaking at all. And over the course of my career, I noticed that I went from having these huge, you know, physical reactions to not having any reaction at all, not any physical reaction. You want that in your doc. You want somebody who's cool and calm and collected, not in a fake way, but internally, by what's going on. And that doesn't mean that they don't have emotions about it, but there's some place you learn to go as a doc in your training where you just earn that place. Now, I will say also that a number of docs have told me that after they retired, they would have several months of crying. And not just the women doctors either. Yeah, I thought it was really interesting.
It's like a deferred reaction to all
right.
The things.
That's right. Their patients they'd see their faces. They would kind of relive this emotion that they couldn't experience at the time. These are particularly not so much the sewing up somebody patients, but the patient who died.
Mm-hmm.
The patient who you really wanted to cure that cancer, and they didn't. They just got sicker and sicker. And
wow. There's
awful.
Your next book. Let's take a call here. We have Mark in Reading on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with
morning.
Dr. Victoria Sweet and the book Slow Medicine. Hi, Mark.
Good morning. I go to a clinic where they use scribes to record everything that happens between the doctor and patient. I was wondering if that is anything to do with slow medicine.
Scribes as in people or software?
Consider it to be useful.
Wait, could you say that again, Mark? You go to a clinic? You run a clinic? I didn't get that.
I'm a patient at a clinic.
Yes. Yes.
That uses scribes to
record
everything that happened between doctor and patient.
Yes, yes. Well, I have strong feelings about that, and I'll tell you. But basically, because electronic health records, so the computer records that the doctors are sitting in front of are terrible. They're terrible. They started in the 70s as a billing platform, and that's where they've evolved from that. And so they're clumsy, they're stupid, and they take all the doctor's time. And this is not just rhetorical. They take between 70 and 110% of the doctor's time to fill out. So the answer to that has been, one of the answers has been a scribe, which is a person, not your doctor, who goes into the room with the doctor and takes notes for the doctor and fills in the electronic health records for the doctor so that the doctor can have his time back, her time back, sit with you, listen to you, and examine you. So to me, this seems like you've built a car that doesn't work, and now you've got a horse attached to it to drag the car along. I mean, why not fix the car? So I think as an interim way, it's a way to try and get that time, that personal face-to-face time back for the doc. I know for myself as a patient, I would be totally taken aback. I would change my relationship, I think. Now, maybe if I got used to that particular scribe, it wouldn't, but there's a lot of things I go to the doctor and I just want to talk to my doc, and I don't want somebody taking notes. So that's how I look at it. It's kind of an interim, and I believe that what we need to do as a practical solution to this problem is fix the electronic health records by coming up with a very simple, inexpensive way that we can document what we do, retain the story, and yet have it be electronic so that if you go to the emergency room, your doc who's not in the emergency room can see what happened. And I think it's pretty easy to come up with it. And I have an idea in my head, so I hope somebody steals the idea.
The more we talk about electronic versus in-person things and hospitalists versus GPs coming into the hospital, stuff, it occurs to me that perhaps what we're really missing is the idea that somebody knows this patient. This was the real problem with your father at the beginning of the book, is that he was in a hospital where nobody knew him or particularly cared about him, and the subtle things that a person who's been dealing with a patient over time would know to look for. It's like, well, his left wrist never did that before, or, you know, that was never yellow over there, that patch of skin, those sorts of things, which is slow medicine. It really is getting to know somebody. It's more than just a minute-by-minute process. It's a year-by-year thing, isn't it?
That's right, and that's... I would say that is the absolute essence of the matter, right there. We've had all these ways to get control of costs, supposedly, but in one of my moments of vision, I realized, no, we're not trying to save money in healthcare. We're trying to make money in healthcare, or a lot of us are, people are. So that model, the doc you're talking about, there's a couple of that's a correct, and many people have realized this, and there's a couple of movements going on where to try to have that happen. One is the concierge model, where you actually pay your doc a monthly fee, and because of that fee, the doc has the time. It can have many fewer patients, doesn't have to spend all his time on the electronic health records, doesn't have to spend any time. If he's a concierge doctor, he doesn't even have to have them, and get that time back and be able to follow you into the hospital. But that's the other issue. So there's another little quirk, which is when the hospitalists came in, what's happened in the last about 10 years is that even if you have a doctor like that, it's become more and more difficult for that doctor to go into your hospital when you get sick and actually take care of you in the hospital because, he has to be on the hospital's sort of formulary and be able to get into those computer records. So even when you have that, so that's the first kind of one answer. And then the second thing is there's a doc who's also an economist in Chicago whose name is David Meltzer, and he's recognized this, and he's come up with a completely new, back-to-the-future model. He calls the comprehensive primary care, and he comes up with this idea of the primary care hospitalist. And he studied the results of a hospitalist group that actually also has a clinic, i.e. a private practice, i.e. when you get discharged, you actually are followed by that quote-unquote hospitalist who actually then becomes your old-fashioned doctor.
Huh.
And he got a grant in 2012 from CMS, and he's actually been doing a randomized study of the costs and benefits of two groups of patients, one who get the kind of care and one who get the kind of care my dad got. And guess what? The group who gets that kind of care, the primary care, hospitalist care, have way like 40% or something like that, fewer ER visits, 15% fewer hospitalizations, fewer medications. And, of course, they stay healthier. They're on fewer medications. It's better all around. So I think there are some answers that are out there percolating so that we can resolve this.
It's interesting to see, though, that they do sort of fall back on ideas that were tried and in some ways discarded in the past.
That's right. That's right. Exactly.
So there are a couple of examples, I guess, of places that are already taking up slow medicine in a very direct way. England has a slow medicine clinic, I understand. Berkeley has a slow medicine project.
Yes, yes. Well, we've been trying to get this together in Berkeley to actually... There are a couple of economists, and it's a small group, to actually get grants to study the results of what happened. Because my initial idea was that if the idea is to save money and slow medicine, however we interpret it, having more time, having better time with patients, being able to follow them in and out of the hospital, however you put that together, if it saves money, and if the point is to save money, then QED, then we're done. So the Berkeley Group is getting grants to be able to, as economists and epidemiologists, to be able to prove that. The Slow Medicine Clinic in England is a small practice where I went and spoke, and she, the doc there, Laura Anderson, started, she just called it a slow medicine clinic. She just put up a sign, slow medicine clinic. And what she did is she gave herself an hour to see patients, and she first signed up her most difficult, complicated patients, the one that were going in and out of the hospital, and sure enough, she found quite quickly that once she had the time to figure out why they were going in and out of the hospital, she had the story, she had the diagnosis, she could figure out the right treatment, and they stopped. So she actually won an award for that clinic.
Okay, so efforts are definitely underway to install
slow medicine
in the world.
That's right. It's happening.
The book is called Slow Medicine, The Way to Healing. Victoria Sweet, a doctor for many years and associate clinical professor of medicine at the University of California, San Francisco, and a prize-winning historian with a PhD in history and social medicine, has been our guest on The Exchange today. Victoria, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Jeff.
Good to talk to you. Good.